Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
Well, I first came to Papua New Guinea because my father decided that I wasn't the type to remain at home. So he gave me £100 and told me I could have the rest of the world to play in. He only wanted one little piece of ground, that was the piece he owned. I was expelled from one of Melbourne's leading colleges for trying to have relations with a young girl from another leading college in the gymnasium. And I was expelled 10 minutes afterwards. I got caught. My uncle, by marriage, was a chief collector of customs in Rabaul, Mr. Featherston E. Phibbs, an Englishman, an uncle by marriage. And he managed, through pulling the right strings, to get permission to come to the territory underage. I wasn't quite 18 at the time. And you had to be 21 before you could come into the territory. And that's how I managed to arrive.
Papua New Guinea, it was once said, attracted missionaries, moneymakers and misfits. It's the object of this particular Time Belong Master program to look at some of the, shall we say, individualists who are attracted to the frontier life offered by a stint in Papua New Guinea. Dr. Hank Nelson.
New Guinea was Australia's frontier. It was open to those who felt constricted by the uniform white British Australianness of their homeland. New Guinea attracted the uninhibited and the eccentric, and it tolerated them when they got there. There was Jumbo Dagan, a giant of a man who fossicked on the old Missima goldfield. He wore just a copra bag, and even when it was unfrayed, it reached only to his waist. The villagers fed him out of charity. There was one notorious planter who lived like a tolerant agnostic sultan with his numerous Papuan wives and many children. There was Billy the cook and Nick the Greek, and Frederick Mantle, the ADO in Rabaul with his distinguished voice and monocled eye. He was matched in Papua by Guy Manning, who insisted that other white men call him Mister. It was, he said, essential for his prestige among the natives. Queen Emma, Tiger Lil, Ma Stewart and Mrs. Marnie, the Queen of Sud-Est, have become legends in two cultures. But many were not distinguished. They had just rejected, or quietly eased away from, the rules that had bound them in their homelands.
I had a boat, only 25-ton schooner, and I had 12 boys and myself. And we used to wear goggles and nothing else practically most of the time. If you wanted to put pants on, you did. If you didn't, it didn't matter because there's nobody else around. We went around all the islands, swimming down and looking along the reef, examining the reef for the trochus shell and the green snail shell. The Japanese used to buy most of the stuff. All the islands, all around the coast, all the islands outside, and there are many of them. And the people are all different. Sort of red-skinned people and some that looked like Chinese, and that was where you, as a young man, you might get a bit of fun there on occasions. It was the sort of life that any young fellow would love to lead. You're just free all day long, swim all day long, no bosses, no nothing, your own boss. I'm 70 years old now, and I'd like to go back to it again tomorrow.
Mostly the places where you saw these characters, the beachcombers and so forth, was where they got their name, along the beach, out on the islands, especially in the offshore islands, Cave Yang, the Admiralties, Trobriand Islands and Don Dracastos out in eastern Papua, where these traders lived, and they sort of lived on their own little islands, and each man sort of became king of his own island, and they lived there for years and years. And though they were eccentric and had strange and wondrous ways, people just sort of regarded that behaviour as the norm, and they were sort of accepted into the community. A lot of them were married locally, and they were sort of part of the scene.
Many of them pretty heavy drinkers, of course, almost inevitably in a situation like that, with nothing else to do but in your spare time but drink. Not many of them were people who would be likely to spend their spare time reading. And what else was there to do but to drink?
I remember one at Kairuku, the assistant resident magistrate fined him £5 for some offence. He had no visible means of support, and he had no money, so he had to go to jail for a week. Of course, in those days, they just had a native jail, and the magistrate wouldn't put him in the native jail, so he had to keep him in his own house. But after 3 days, he got so fed up with this prisoner that he paid the fine himself and let the man go.
In the days before government tax came in, which was about 1958, I think, several of the missions used to conduct fundraising campaigns, which, for want of a better name, were known as tax. And it was called mission tax. And what would happen would be the mission boat would go along the coast and stop off at each village and go ashore and ask for contributions, and people would contribute what they could, and this would go towards mission funds for running the hospital and the schools and so forth. For each individual village didn't amount to much, but overall it was quite a tidy sum. One day, just before the annual mission tax was to be collected, a bearded beachcomber decided that he could cash in on this. So he arrived at this village wearing a pair of sandals, dressed in a white robe, and stepped ashore and was greeted by a village chief who looked a bit nonplussed at him, and this fellow said, "Well, have you got my tax? I've come to collect my tax." "Well, who are you?" And he said, "Well, haven't you seen the pictures in your church? I'm Jesus." And big black beard, white robe, sandals, just like in the pictures in the church. And they said, "Oh, yeah, Jesus come to collect his tax." So the talk went round the village, and everybody contributed more than they normally did because they realised that Jesus was real and wasn't just somebody that the mission had invented. So he went away with a tidy sum of money from that particular village. So having worked well there, he kept on going down the coast and collected this vast fortune, and then promptly disappeared. Anyway, a week later, the mission boat arrived and rang the bell and said, "All right, people have come to collect your kind contributions to the mission this year." And the village headman said, "Oh, we've already contributed this year." He said, "Jesus came through here last week." And the old missionary said, I don't think that'd be right." And he said, "Oh, yeah, you always said that Jesus would come again." "Well, he came, all right, he came last week." And he asked for his tax, and we gave it to him, and he left. And the missionary could hardly deny that it was to be a second coming and all that sort of thing, but even he was tempted not to believe, you see. So he went on to the next village and he got the same story. In the end, he realised that the mission had been had, you see. So he didn't know what to do about it, because collecting the tax in the form in which it was collected was, of course, illegal. But eventually he summed up enough courage to go along to the local district officer, and he told the story, you see. And the district officer said, "Oh, yeah." And hummed and hard and said, "Well, what do you want me to do about it?" And the missionary said, "Well," he said, "you know, you should go off and get this fellow. He's charging with impersonation." And the cab said, "Well, who's he impersonating?" And the missionary said, "Jesus, the Son of God. He's saying that he was the Son of God." So the Kiap said, "Well, let me refresh your mind a little bit." He said, "About 2,000 years ago," he said, "there was a man on this earth who said that he was the Son of God too." And he said, "The local priest complained, and they went up to the local Kiap. And the local Kiap's name was Pontius Pilate. And he condemned that man because he said he was the Son of God. And he said, and his name has been dragged through history ever since." And he said, "If you think my name's going to be dragged through history for the next 2,000 years, he said, "you've got another thing coming. This man says he's the Son of God. He can, so far as I'm concerned, he can stay the Son of God." And case is closed.
One of New Guinea's most remembered characters is Errol Flynn. In 1927, Flynn, who had just been defeated in the New South Wales amateur boxing titles and recently sacked from his job as an office boy, sailed north on the Montoro. He was then 18.
Errol Flynn came to Rabaul 27 or 28, not very long after I got there anyhow, and he turned up. I had a little table just outside the administrator's office. right at the little window. It was really where people who wanted to see the administrator would come and see me, you see. And this chappie turned up off a ship which had just arrived from Australia with a letter of introduction to General Wisdom. I took him in, he met the administrator. Well, he got a job as a sort of a patrol officer for a while, but he didn't stay in there very long.
Their old friend arrived up there. Broke, he'd been kicked out of the administration, and he came up to Wow and got into the pub, and he borrowed money from as many people as he could, and then skipped it on a boat. And my old partner, George Arnold, we were on the Wattet at the time, and he went into Wow, and he gave Errol Flynn £100 to help him, but Errol was going to pay him back. And when we got short of a bit of money, so he wrote to Flynn, and he sent him back a photograph with his name on it, but no money. Errol Flynn.
He was a good looker. And you know what men are like, you know, up in a place like that. I saw Errol have a fight one night in the bar. The miners were funny people. They didn't like anyone that was good looking or anyone, you know, that. And he was a bit swashbuckly, but he was a pleasure to have in the place.
I flattened Errol Flynn in the Corribo Hotel. Another man was going to do it. He was playing around with another bloke's wife. And one thing led to another. I only hit him once. He went down and he stopped and he wouldn't get up again. That was the type he was. Wasn't a decent sort of bloke, put it that way. It was just his whole attitude towards women, especially the white women, that got our backs up. The white women had to be specially protected. And we had to all, no matter who you were or what you were, nothing but respect for them. And he was the sort of person that, you know, didn't give a bugger about that. Anyhow, I shouldn't talk. I'm a great-grandfather and I haven't been married yet.
He was a very unscrupulous man, and he'd drop in anywhere. And I can remember Paddy saying to me, look out for that blood, you really eat everything and take everything. He was a happy-go-lucky fellow who'd steal anybody's wife or dog, or, and it didn't matter whether the wife was black or white or what she was. In 1936, when Mick and I went on a world tour, Mick and I both did see him. He was married to Lily Demeter then, and he came out and met me and took me through Universal Studios. And I can remember he was telling a story of Papua New Guinea in Universal Studios, and the bulk of it was, from what I can remember, was how, you know, if you walk out of your camp, you're likely to get a spear, and if you walk down the road, they were firing arrows at you, and everything was hair-raising and highly dangerous. And when he came back to me, he said, how did I go? Because I was there portion of the time, and I had been on this trip out to the Goldfield with him. He mentioned something about that too, of course, highly exaggerated. Oh, I said, I thought you went very well. I didn't know it was like that there. And he said, oh, well, that's the kind of bullshit they like.
Flynn finally left New Guinea in 1933. 2 years later, he made his first successful Hollywood film, Captain Blood. In small movie houses and at outdoor screenings, the white residents of Papua and New Guinea looked upon the flickering swashbuckler who had already displayed many roles for them. They'd seen him as the jodhpur-clad fop, the pub fighter, the failed planter and miner, and the laughing, engaging scoundrel. They met his appearance on screen with cries of, "Where's my money, Flinny?" And Eric Ween, the fighting dentist from Wow, got the greatest laugh when he demanded a credit on film for repairing Flynn's splendid teeth. One character that Flynn could have played, on screen or in his imagination, was Shanghai Brown.
He was originally from the China coast. He came down and was running a recruiting ship for Balolo gold dredging. He was a recruiter, but very much of the old Pakasahab school, though he used to always wear an American baseball cap.
Brown wasn't his name. His name was Yates, and I think he'd got into a bit of trouble in England. He'd tell you this when he got a bit full, which was all the time. And I think he had a bit of trouble in England and came out here and changed his name. He had two or three native wives up there, and he'd built a house in Angoram. And he used to have a harem there, of course. And one girl he called the Princess. Shanghai was the big king there. He used to walk about with a knotted cane all the time. He was a tall fellow, he was over 6 feet. There was a paper published in the early days, before the war. It had a cartoon in of Shanghai leaving for work. Shanghai with his walking stick and his pair of white shorts and white shirt and his big straw hat he used to wear there. You know, the ones the natives weep and palm leaves. About 8 boys, personal boys, walking behind him, one with a case of gin, another with an umbrella, another with a fly whisk, another with a deck chair. This is Shanghai going to work. Pakasab or Shanghai. But he never actually mixed with the European population. He'd built quite a nice house there on the seabed. He had skulls they'd collected all around it. He was a loner. I suppose he was born that way, I don't know.
He finally committed suicide many years later, but Shanghai had never drunk water in his life, so he took an overdose of sleeping tablets in his rum.
One of the most famous and loved identities of New Guinea was the redoubtable Mrs. Flora Stewart, always known as Ma Stewart.
Ma Stewart had lived in Port Moresby, Samurai and Sulamar before she became known territory-wide as a proprietor of the Wow Pub. The large barroom with its billiard table in the corner was the social centre of the Goldfields in the early 30s. There, Ma Stewart, tough, generous and resourceful, presided over the drinking, arguing and brawling. In 1936, she opened the first hotel in Lae.
She had the Hotel Cecil before the war and had just established it in Lae. It was a going concern and it was managed by her daughter, Ela. And, of course, that all went during the war. It was bombed out of existence. And so as soon as the war was over, I think May was the first woman back, she wanted to start her hotel again. And the army allowed her to take over these little huts which had been built for the AWARs, the Australian women soldiers that were up there, so that when you went to stay at Mars Hotel Cecil, you had one of these rooms, and you could never really say you slept on your own, because if it was a long room, there'd only be a sheet of 3-ply anyway, and that didn't go to the top of the room, it didn't go to the bottom. But first time I stayed there, I'd come back for the baby. He'd been sick. I wake up in the night and I said, oh, good God, Guria, earthquake. It's heaving around and I, half asleep, didn't know what you're doing. And I went to step out of bed and I put my foot on this damn thing and it was a pig, it wasn't an earthquake. It was a pig under the bed. And of course, it had tried to stand up and found it couldn't shift me. So, however, that was par for the course.
I'll never forget the Church of England minister. He used to get around in his robes. And those days was, well, the Klondike. And Ma offended him. She said, if you get out of those bloody skirts, you might get a few people to your church. And that was Ma. And that would be Ma in a nutshell, plain speaking. And she never lost any friends from plain speaking, because the things that happened to her over the years. Now, I knew one person. He worked with me on the road. He was quite a character. His name was Nippy Wallace. We'd come down and the first thing Nippy would do would get the 2 towels in the room, put them in the bottom of his suitcase, and then ring down or buzz down or go down and say there's no towels in his room. And that's what Ma had to put up with all the years, and she was a great lady.
She was the first civilian lady to come back to New Guinea after the war. Now, with all these thousands of vehicles going up and down the road, she was the only woman that had to walk on the road, because the army law is no civilian woman can be picked up in an army vehicle. She was wearing men's sandals because she'd worn out her shoes. Her clothes were split at the back from perspiration. She was burnt black from the sun and yellow from the atabrin. She really could have passed for a Japanese lady. She was so dark. But this is true. Any man, the truck would stop and pick up a man. But the law is no civilian woman could be given any help whatsoever. And it was thanks to Major Robertson who helped us to get the Awas barracks. And this is how we started the Hotel Cecil in 46 after the war.
She was a tremendously kind and generous person. Stray dogs were fed and dissipated and lonely old men were given jobs and looked after. And she was a very kind person and a very efficient hotelier. She fought a great fight, of course, for the Hotel Cecil site, all that the government wanted to turn into park. But she had a pre-war lease and she utterly refused. And with great government opposition, she built the Hotel Cecil.
You wouldn't believe it, but we started a hotel without one drop of drink in it. Because of having no beer quota, none of the breweries in Australia would supply us with beer. So we had to then depend on buying it from Manila and from the East and from wherever we could get it. We had St. Pauli Girl, you know, names that you've never ever heard of in your life before, Three Elephants, all these funny names. Revolver, which honestly it was the most terrible thing, came from Scotland. You couldn't even sell it for sixpence in those days for a bottle, it was that dreadful. So the only thing that we could buy was altar wine that the army sold. And I remember Bob Morgan, he wanted to know what he'd ever done to us. He used to get very waddling on this altar wine. And so that's what everybody had to drink. Well then, I remember the day I opened up was on the 9th of April. And, you know, army fellows arrived in cars thinking there was a hotel they were going to buy. I said, oh no, we haven't got any drink. And it wasn't until August that I got the first consignment of beer. We opened a dry hotel, it was just accommodation.
Ma went to church this night, Sunday night, and she always had a piano in the main dining room. And we'd carried the piano out from the main dining room out to the workers' dining room. I think it was after a football match. And it was Tommy Malcolmson, and he wasn't a bad pianist, not very good, but... So Tommy's playing us dinner music. Ma came home, spotted what was going on, kept walking into the main dining room, through the kitchen, and came out with the biggest saucepan I've ever seen in my life, and hit Tommy on the back of the head. Well, Tommy collapsed. And I think four of us carried the piano out into the workers, but it took about 10 of her staff to carry it back. You could take Ma so far, but you knew when to stop.
My mother was greatly respected. Now, for instance, this is just one instance. There were two men that they loved to fight. One used to take his teeth out and pop them on the desk. The other one would take his glass of eye and put it on the table, and then they would go outside. Some other would say, no fighting. She said, I'd hold the lamp for you outside, but outside. And she would. She'd go outside and hold the lamp for them. They'd have their fight. Then they'd back, they'd come in. And I couldn't understand that as a schoolgirl, how two men could be fighting and the next minute's drinking. But it was like sport for them. But I actually saw her beat her, not exactly beating, but she gave a damn good crack. He hit a man that only had one arm and she protected him. But the good that my mother did and the kindness that she gave has never been recorded. Whenever I hear anything that it is disparaging, I just say, just ask that person how much money they owe her.
There was a guy that used to talk all the time. If he wasn't talking, he used to whistle, but he was never silent, so they nicknamed him Walkie Talkie.
This Walkie Talkie she's talking about, at the opening of the Hotel Cecil, old Ma turned the grog on. This bar, this public bar, was a full stainless steel bar. So this walkie-talkie was one of those blokes that was playing practical jokes. He'd got the generator from a DC-3. He hooked it up to this stainless steel bar. So the drinks were on, everybody's into it. And you're like sort of leaning on the stainless steel bar, and yak, yak, yakking away and going on. And he watched and he waited until everybody, practically everybody, had some part of their body on this stainless steel bar, and he'd give this thing a whack. Because beer would... what's coming? Everybody's coming, you see. So the big laugh, she's all over.
because I settled down again and the grog's on again. Back goes the elbows. The yak, 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 and away to go. He waits it all and he gives another go. And away goes the lot again. Because a great big laugh. And from there on, all those months that was on the opening of the Hotel Cecil, they stand up and drink their beer like this. With the elbow right square to their shoulder. Yeah, and poor old walkie-talkie, when they buried him where it lay, and they put him down, and the front rope broke, and he speared the other the grave. Do you remember that? Poor old walkie-talkie. Good luck.
One of the first major roads built in New Guinea was from Lae up through the mountains to the goldfields of Balolo and Wau. This road, begun during the war, was at first little better than a muddy track and subject to heavy rain and frequent landslips. It was hard on men and machines. D'Arcy Williams was one of the early transport drivers on this run. The drivers used to overnight at Labu.
We all had our own room. There was about five or six rooms over there in Labu. And it wasn't a bad sort of a place either. But they had this bloke named Jack Snattery. And he used to run a line, a labour line. Boombashers, they used to call him in those days. He had this big red moustache that he used to call out he liked, you see. And he was always on the grog. He was like sort of habitually drunk, you know. But a good bloke. However, this night I got into Labu about 11 o'clock and I'm buggered, I've had it, you know. Been going for about 20 hours. When I get into Midonga, here's Snattery, you see, and she's out like a light on my bed. So I just got my boots off, pull my boots off and put them in the middle of the floor, drag Snattery off, put his head on my boots, and he's still sound asleep, he didn't wake up. And there he stayed. The next morning we woke up, they had rats over there as big as cats. And where his mow was sticking up on the outside here, the rats had eaten it all off. And he only had one side of his mow. We found out later that Johnny Collins had cooked curry for dinner that night, you know. And where they couldn't get out, they couldn't get out, they ate the rest of it. He was having only half a mow.
Had the rats eaten anything vital, Half Mo Jack might have had to get aid from a man as notorious as himself. Dr. John McInerney was one of several territory doctors whose exploits are rapidly passing into legend. A Sydney graduate, McInerney served in the commandos and trained as a paratrooper. In war, he was more interested in killing than curing. In the post-war, he went as a government medical officer to the Sepik district. A wild, hefty, impetuous man, his character was sometimes in conflict with his undoubted skills as surgeon and physician. Although once both came together, he felled a man, then immediately performed the emergency surgery to save him. He was constantly disappearing, getting caught in some improbable escapade, reappearing for a spell of frontier doctoring, and then again entangling himself in what would become the basis of yet another Dr. John anecdote.
John McInerney, well, he was probably one of the characters. He was always a very hard case. He ultimately killed himself taking off from Wanamo in an aeroplane which had no airspeed indicator, an Oster, his own aeroplane, because it had a Hornet in the pedo head. He had a tin trunk and two passengers with him, and the old Wanamo was a very nasty little aerodrome, and he took off downwind in what I would have considered an overloaded aeroplane without an airspeed, and he didn't bother doing his straps up. Undoubtedly, with the wind coming from behind, he sensed he was going faster than he was when he got out over the water. It must have been marginal getting off, but he did a split-ass turn and speared straight in, and he knocked himself out, and he was actually drowned while the other two clambered out safely. He did some extraordinary things. He liked dogs more than people, I think.
Fred Bannigan was a notorious character in the country. And Fred had a habit in the old pub, this is the Awa's Barracks, going back to 1947, of sitting up in the bar. This night he got drunk,
and fell off the bar and knocked himself out. He had a nosebleed. So this Rusty Phillips, ex-Irish guardsman he was, because he was a bit of a dramatic, and he asked anyone that I have a vehicle, I must race this chap to the hospital, you know. So someone said, oh, there's my Jeep out there. So he picked up Bannigan bodily and carried him out, put him in the Jeep, and took off, heading for the hospital. But he threw Fred Bannigan out of the Jeep as he swung out of the pub onto the bitumen. Well, then Fred did need the doctor. So he gets Fred in hospital and get him in the bed, no doctor, and he waits and he waits and he waits. So he went around to the doctor's residence. He starts knocking on the door, and eventually this Dr. McEnany, who was quite a tough, fairly violent man, so he came to the door and he said, who is it? Rusty Phillips. So he had hold on. So then he waited a few seconds, opened the door and went whack and hit Rusty. So he ended up Bannigan ended up in hospital for 2 weeks and Rusty finished in hospital for the night.
There'll be many people in Papua New Guinea today who will remember Doc McEnany. And Doc used to fly regularly along the north coast of the Sepik district from Wewak to Itapee and places like that. And I was at Vonimo at the time, and he used to come in every fortnight and bring my mail and my freezer goods, you know, my butter and my fresh meat and urgent medical and food supplies. And this particular day, he was due in on, say, the Friday morning, and I went down to the airstrip to wait for him, and I heard the aircraft in the sky and eventually saw it, just a tiny little speck in the sky. And I waited and waited, and it was quite obvious he wasn't going to land, and he didn't land. He flew over at about 10,000 feet, heading westwards, obviously going to what was then Hollandia, which was one of his ports of call. And I was a bit annoyed because I didn't get any mail, didn't get any freezer, and didn't get all the things I wanted. So I waited then. A fortnight later, he came back, and when he landed and after he got out and given me all my freezer and mail and things for this week, I said, well, you're a bright sort of son, so you let me down last week. And he said, oh, I'm sorry I couldn't land. I had to go straight through to Hollandia. He said, but did you get your butter? And I said, no, what do you mean did I get my butter? And he said, oh, well, I threw it out for you. I had visions of 2 pounds of butter coming down from 10,000 feet. It's probably still somewhere in the jungle, wrapped up with G.P. Taylor on.
Now, after John McEnany learnt to fly, he, instead of me flying him, he often would take an aircraft, one of my aeroplanes, charter it and for the administration and do his own flying, which suited me nicely. It saved my pilots. One day he went into Telefomen, and he had a can of petrol with him, but he had forgotten to take the tube and the funnel to pour the petrol into the slipper tank. On the way back from... Oh, he couldn't get into Telefomen, and he turned back. The weather was pretty foul, and he had no way of getting the petrol from the can into the bottom tank. Eventually, he unscrewed the fuel gauge, which was in the cockpit on top of the tank. He unscrewed it, which was quite hazardous, and he tipped the petrol in. He must have spilled petrol everywhere. And eventually, his navigation in those days wasn't awfully good. Instead of landing back at Wewak, he ended at Wanamo, which was an hour's flight away. But he had saved the aeroplane and saved his neck. At least he got down. So he was quite an ingenious sort of a person.
Of course, the government service wasn't without its notable individualists. Patrol officers, or KIAPs as they were usually called in New Guinea, often spent many months and sometimes years in very isolated circumstances. This could take its toll. One of the great KIAP characters of my time in Papua New Guinea, who perhaps would best be nameless, he was a legendary figure in the Sepik area, and he spent a lot of time at Angoram. And he was a great big chap and terribly overweight, tremendously overweight. He was a prodigious drinker and eater. And it's said that his favourite trick was to invite somebody to dinner, and then after dinner, while they were all sitting around having coffee, he'd just pick up the unfinished leg of lamb and with a penknife, he'd just sit there and pare his way through this leg of lamb after dinner and probably demolish it all, or a leg of pork or something, and this was something he used to do. But he had this rather strange arrangement. He had a Japanese bugle, which somebody had found in the jungle, which he had nailed to the wall of his living room,
And he had also, because he's so big and so ungainly, he used to crash through all the dining room chairs that anyone ever got for him. So he had this special chair built. It was like a great big royal throne, you see. And he used to sit in this. And underneath his right arm, screwed to this chair, was one of those little rubber horn things like you have on a kid's pedal car that goes sort of pom-pom when you squeeze it, you see. And he had this so positioned that it just nestled in underneath his armpit. And from this rubber horn, there ran a long length of garden hose up to this Japanese bugle on the wall. And so when he wanted service, all he did was just press his arm in, you see, and you'd have this pom-pom on the wall. And then from the kitchen, there'd be, "Yes, sir," and he'd call out, "More beer," or something, and then his servant had come rushing in with more beer or more food or whatever. And this chap was, as I say, a legendary character, and anyone who'd been in this area at that time sooner or later came to see this performance. Anyway, he got quite ill, probably from excesses of one kind or another, and the local medico said to him, "Look, you know, you really will have to cut down on your eating and your drinking. You'll have to get some good food into you, and you need more fresh vegetables and a more balanced diet." So he took all this on board and sent a telegram off to Madang, where we used to get our supplies. And he sent this long telegram to Madang saying, "Please send me this and this and this and this." And he included in his order, bearing in mind the doctor's advice, one case of carrots so that he could get the fresh vegetables, you see. And the chap in Madang saw this from this familiar person, and he looked down the list. And when he came to this case of carrots, he said, "Oh, that's wrong." He said, that must have been garbled in transmission. What he means is a case of claret. Send him a case of claret. So my friend didn't get his case of carrots, but he got the last thing he wanted in the way, which is a case of claret.
Australian ministers of territories in Canberra and various lieutenant governors and administrators in Port Moresby and Rabaul set down policies. But the villagers came into contact with people, not policies. And when they think about their years under Australian rule, they may well remember masters of gargantuan appetites or wild eccentricities. Historians will have to accept that some of the most improbable stories told by Papua New Guineans of their recent rulers are true. Perhaps government and farce are never far apart.
There was a strongly held belief in the higher echelons of the Australian administration in Papua New Guinea that the best training for cadet patrol officers was on the job. Chris Vass, who was posted to LIGAM in the very early days of the opening up of the Western Highlands, went to his first posting at the tender age of 20.
Arrived there one evening, met by the assistant district officer, who at that time was a man by the name of Dennis Faithful, a real character, had actually spent most of his time in the Sepik district before he'd been posted to the Western Highlands. But he had a bit of a reputation, which I'd heard of even in my short time there. People were saying, "My God, you're going to Faithful Station. Half your luck, you know." So I arrived there, met by this man, a big bushy moustache, not a very tall man, but fairly wild looking. He showed me around the station briefly, showed me to my house, which was a peculiar sort of a place. It was a timber home. It was the only timber place in the station, actually. Everything else was built out of bush materials, grass roofs and plaited walls. But this timber house was perched up on the side of a hill, and it was pink. Some character at some stage or other painted it as bright pink colour, and it had a grass roof. So I was sort of ensconced in this, left to my own resources. So Faithful said, "Right, off you go, Vass. You're sleeping in there. Come down later on this evening and we'll have a few grogs." So, you know, I went off, cleaned myself up, had a look around the house and went down to start what turned out to be numerous drinking sessions with Dennis Faithful. We were sitting in his lounge room, which was a very large room, and the centrepiece of this lounge room was a magnificent fireplace, which Faithful was renowned for throughout Papua New Guinea. He was the master fireplace builder. Every place he went into, he always made sure that if there wasn't a fireplace, there was very shortly afterwards. And in LIGAM, he'd built this magnificent affair. And that particular night, it was cold, as it was every night in LIGAM, because it's just over 7,000 feet there. And about 10 p.m, we'd been drinking quite solidly for some time, the two of us, sitting in the middle of this magnificent room with the fire blazing away. And on a nearby table, there was one of those old portable record players. And Faithful had one record. I think from memory it was a Trini Lopez record. And there's nothing worse than Trini Lopez when he goes on and on and on. He's bad enough once without hearing him repeatedly. And Faithful would put this record on and play it over and over again. And after you'd had a few grogs, I suppose you didn't mind. So on this particular night, we're there at 10 o'clock and Trini Lopez is going round and round, and my head was going round and round, being a young man, not used to that sort of drinking. And I happened to glance across to the fire and notice that what seemed to me to be a flame leaping up from the wall adjacent to the fireplace. And I said to Faithful, "Dennis, I think the house is on fire." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about it, it's nothing. Now have another drink." So I proceeded to have another drink and looked at it again, and the wall was definitely on fire, and the flames were starting to leap up the side of the wall. And I said, "Faithful, the bloody house is on fire." He said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Sit down and have another drink." I said, "My God, man, the whole bloody house will burn down." He said, "That's all right." And he sung out Calaboose. And Calaboose is the pidgin word for prisoner. And at that stage, or it was common practice throughout the Highlands, that each government officer would have a prisoner working on his house around the garden area and just sort of generally helping out in the house. So Dennis, had, by singing out Calaboose, had sung out for the prisoner to come in. And this poor prisoner leapt into the room with a red lap-lap on, nothing else, and took one look at the wall, and his jaw dropped about 5 feet and eyes sort of stuck out of his head. And Dennis said, "Make him die fire," which means put the fire out. And of course Dennis hadn't moved from his chair at this stage. He's still sitting there with drink in hand, and so was I, on his orders. So the Calaboose leapt out of the room and went to get the bucket. And of course at that stage he'd made enough noise to wake up half the station, so the whole police detachment and half the station came down into the house with buckets of water, and there's water flying everywhere, there's flames all over the place. And in the end the whole wall dropped out into the night on the side away from us. And in the meantime, Faithful hadn't moved from his chair. The record, Trini Lopez, is still yodeling away. The record was still spinning around. And I, under instructions from the boss, was still sitting in the chair next to him, drinking grog. And so finally, you know, the fire was put out. The station calmed down. The fireplace, the magnificent edifice, was still standing in the middle of a vacant wall. Faithful still drinking, and we're sitting there looking at the stars. I don't know whether it was a typical night like him, but it was the sort of thing that one came to expect from Faithful, though, after a while. You know. My first week in New Guinea, in actual fact, my first week on a posting. So I thought, my God, what have I come to? You know, what is this?
In Moneymakers and Misfits, you heard the voices of Harry Hugo, Percy Chatterton, Malcolm McKellar, Claude Champion, Clive Mears, Jerry Pentland, Lillian Barclay-Miller, Jim Lay, John Middleton, Ted Whitehead, Andre Millar, Tom Hilliard, Ela Birrell, Lloyd Hurrell, Ginny Williams, Darcy Williams, Bobby Gibbs, Graham Taylor, and Chris Vass. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, Fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.